Consumer Protection to order. Today's Tuesday, February 3rd, 2009. We'll try to keep moving. We've got a pretty important bill up this afternoon and a lot of interest in it. So, Senator Shy, do you want to proceed with Senate File 166, the Insurable Interest Act? Senator Shy.
Technical part of it, and maybe Mr. Stanton.
The members, that all right? Senator Shied moves the A8 amendment to get the bill in the shape she'd like it. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, motion prevailed. Senator Shied.
Hey, Chairman, thank you. I struggled with how to begin the hearing today, and because I feel pretty passionately about this subject. And I think the committee members are aware that other people feel passionately about it as well. Your chair who brought you bad faith for 2 years in a row is now before you with another difficult issue. And these issues are difficult. And this is the Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee. And we deal with, obviously, issues related to commerce, and insurance is one of those big issues, and we care about the insurance marketplace. And that is one of my strongest motivations in being here, is to protect the marketplace in a sense, protect consumers in the marketplace. Consumer protection was something that I suggested be added to this committee title. It didn't used to be that. You're going to hear about consumers on both sides of this. I'm concerned about all consumers, that all consumers who enter into any transaction regarding their life insurance understand all the consequences of what they're doing, whether it's got to do with whether or not an event is taxable, whether or if it isn't, what their rights are, and who the beneficiary is. I'm going to read something to you from a website of a life settlement company. This bill has to do with insurable interests or STOLI, not the vodka, the stranger-originated life insurance. But I think everybody calls this bill having to do with STOLI. This investment group assists you to create wealth by taking advantage of a hidden asset, your unused insurance capacity. Much like finding a Picasso in your attic, this asset can often go unrecognized or underappreciated. Your unused insurable capacity is equal to your total asset value less any existing insurance that you already own. So in other words, it's insurance you don't own yet. You don't have, this is not a policy that you and I may already have on our lives. This is something, or it's on top of whatever you already own. Are you aware that you can reap tremendous monetary rewards solely from your ability to purchase life insurance? It's easy, and we're delighted to show you how. Those are the kinds of promotions that you can go online, by the way, and get information and sign up to apply for their services. And there are a number of companies out there across the country doing this. And I think you'll understand as we go through the bill and if I make comments going forward about what my concerns are. And one of the things I want to highlight for you is that there's a market for these, what are called, I think by people in the industry, death bonds. There's a market for this on Wall Street. And such companies as Bear Stearns, remember them, Merrill Lynch, and others are purchasers of bundles of these securitized instruments that they've invested in, or that somebody has invested in through them, we know what happened when they bundled our mortgages, and I don't think we want to see Wall Street in charge of this product. And right, it's a burgeoning market. Albeit, I'll understand that there are some pressures on it now because of the economy, but it is, however, happening, and I think we need to be very, very cautious. And then I want to draw your attention to a map. As we go through, it's not as if I'm seeking to make Minnesota an island. Other states are definitely considering this topic. And it's been something of very strong interest at the NAIC, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and also the National Conference of Insurance Legislators, NCOIL. And both of these organizations have a model. The models differ. The NAIC model bans anybody from making a life settlement agreement for 5 years. And ours does not do that. The bill I'm presenting does not ban that. So I think, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to go through the bill. And I think I owe that to you.
Sure.
To the committee. Obviously, we see it's called the Insurable Interest Act. Maybe Ms. Rowan would just define insurable interest for you. It's pretty self-explanatory. Do you mind?
No.
Ms. Rowan, welcome to the committee. Identify yourself for the team.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. We represent life insurers and provide other kinds of financial security products to Minnesotans. Senator Scheid asked me to define insurable interest. It's pretty simple. It is the foundation of life insurance. The idea is that the beneficiary of a life insurance policy has to have a strong interest in the policyholder staying alive, greater than they have an interest in seeing them die. And the reason for that is a moral hazard. Courts as far back as the 17th century have said that a life insurance policy without an insurable interest is nothing more than a wager on human life. And we're not suggesting today that investors are running around knocking off seniors to get their death benefits, although I will point out that if anyone watches crime shows like CSI or Law and Order, the first question they ask over the body is, did they have a life insurance policy and who got the proceeds? The idea is more that as a society, we don't want people having a direct economic incentive in hastening the demise of other citizens. And that's basically the concept of insurable interest.
Okay.
Senator.
So, Mr. Chairman, members, so the title is the Insurable Interest Act. You have the definitions that
did
will...
Did we follow this?
Ms. Sliwa has done the summary of the bill, and I can take you through. I will tell you that there are bits and pieces of other states' laws that are woven into here. So it is really a hybrid. I don't think anybody has passed this bill as it is before you. I don't think any state has done that. Some have done the outright ban. I think 5 states have done that. The NAIC model, and 7 have done some version, I think, of the NCOIL model. So one of the more interesting definitional terms is down on it's page 1, line 22, life expectancy evaluation. And, I mean, somebody said to me, well, this is the very same thing that an insurance company does when they sell you a life insurance policy. And I had to honestly say, because I do have some life insurance, that I have not ever been subjected to a life expectancy evaluation. It really isn't going in and getting a checkup with your doctor. It's signing an authorization form, a release of information, and for all of your medical records to be submitted to a company that will determine, based on your medical history, your life expectancy. I don't know if they share that with the potential insurance purchaser or not, but I do know that it's a real, well, I don't know, maybe it's more of an art these days, because we have a company in Minneapolis that had to somewhat apologize because their tables were off and they were projecting shorter life expectancies for people, and they found out that we were living longer and said, let's see, how do we, where's the line, Iowa? And so they have suffered some business. They estimate that their new tables include life expectancy estimates that are 20 to 25% longer than they originally forecast. And that disrupted the market by causing policies and portfolios to drop in value. Are you understanding that the lower your life expectancy, the fewer years they expect you to live, the higher value your policy, the more they'll pay you for it, if you will. Okay? So Ms. Rowan talked about people having an interest in your living. And an insurance company selling you a life insurance product has a strong interest in your living longer because they will collect the premiums. A life settlement company or the people who invest in that product have a stronger interest in you dying sooner rather than later. It's inverse, and I think it's perverse. So, and that's part of my passion here. But that's a life expectancy evaluation is not, you know, a finger stick and weighing you and taking your blood pressure like most of us have to had go through to get a life insurance policy. It's a whole reading by a company like 21st Services, the company in Minneapolis that I didn't name before, but I just did, that does look at those records and determine your life expectancy. Okay, so the definition of settlement contract is, do you want to comment on that? That's on page 2. This is from the NAIC model. This says what a settlement contract is. This is what life settlement companies do. So this has to do with the person who has the insurance policy selling that policy, if you will, signing it over to a life settlement company where through various mechanisms, perhaps through a trust, the beneficiary is changed. And it's no longer probably your family or your business partner that's named in the policy. It's an investor. And so that's then down on line 2.30. It tells you what it does not include. I don't know if that's important to emphasize. And we get over on page 3, line 27, stranger-originated life insurance practices. Those are STOLI. That we've taken some of this language from the NCOIL model, although we've added the word act on line 28. Means an act, practice, or arrangement to initiate a life insurance policy for the benefit of a third-party investor. Or maybe I can just... Okay, I'll do that. Okay. So I'm going to keep walking through. I think that's, yeah, the best thing to hear. So Kansas has the word act in it. Otherwise, it's pretty much the NCOIL language. And I think practices is added by us as well on line 30. But that's just technical. We require the insurable interest to purchase life insurance. That's Ms. Rowan just explained to you. And I think down on line page 4, line 16, B, an individual has an insurable interest. That language is essentially what 24 other states already have as describing or defining an insurable interest. Let's see. And then item C has to do with a small business, if I'm not sure, in a buy-sell agreement. So that is not for the benefit of the family, but it would be for the benefit perhaps of a partner, a business partner. And to page 5, line 15, is the key man kind of and that requires the consent, I believe, of the person who's being insured. And then page 6, the top, the consent of the person who's insured is defined or it's required, but there are cases where people may have someone else give consent. If it's somebody having legal custody over a minor or a court-appointed guardian or conservator, et cetera.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, backing up to page 5, subdivision 4, says reliance on statements. And if you recall when we had this issue come up, just kind of an introductory meeting, and we talked about, or I talked about my concern about statements made by an insured being used to, that might be even some kind of innocuous statements being used to prevent proceeds from being paid. And I wonder, is there already something like this in law, or are we adding anything that might make it more difficult for consumers to collect on a policy? And I ask that because this looks like what concerns me is, for example, there's a questionnaire and it says, have you ever suffered from X illness? And maybe the person simply just either has a different interpretation of that question or maybe they forgot. But the company has an opportunity to review their medical records and usually does do a very thorough medical review. And yet this seems to be opening a door to the possibility of not making a payment based on claiming after the fact that, you know, that there was some inaccurate information given.
I'm going to ask Ms. Rowan to respond just because she knows how it's handled now.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, thank you very much. This particular section doesn't have to do with the insurer paying claims. What it has to do with is whether the insurer can rely upon statements made as to whether an insurable interest was present or not. And it has to do with an insurance company can be sued for not discovering that there was no insurable interest if later on the beneficiary kills the insured. The insurance company can be found liable for that. So that has to do with that situation and not in terms of paying a claim.
Okay.
Continue on.
Then, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Page 6, section 4, line 20, discusses the prohibited practices, and this is where you'll see the term on line 624, engage in STOLI practices. We know it's STOLI, a stranger-originated life insurance, or otherwise wager on life. And I believe the wager on life phrase is from a court case saying that this kind of an arrangement can be wagering on human life. This is what we say you may not solicit or promote the purchase of a policy just for the purpose of or emphasizing the subsequent sale of that in the secondary market, which is the life settlement company's arena. So you can't induce somebody to take out this life insurance policy for the purpose of selling it. Doesn't mean that you can't later sell it. And I believe that you could tell someone that it's a possibility. How could you not tell someone? Because it is a possibility that you may sell that later. But to get somebody to purchase the policy for the purpose of turning it over after a period of time, it would be a prohibited practice. Did I say that correctly? Then a premium finance agreement. This is item 4 on line 27 of page 6. In many of the transactions that I've seen in newscasts and in articles, either in newsletters or online, there you might even see, may have seen advertised someplace, free insurance, where the person who is seeking the insurance actually isn't paying the premiums for the insurance, that a third party is doing that, and that would not be allowed to finance that premium. Let's see, do we let them do that in any other case? I mean, so it's not undoing the financing, it's just putting restrictions on that. And I think that's a blend of the NAIC and the NCOIL language. I think Ohio has done some of this, or maybe this is their language, perhaps. In any case, that's and then entering on page 7 up at the top, entering or offering to enter into a settlement contract before the policy is issued. That would be a prohibited practice. Line 6 on page 7, the presumption of the stranger-originated life insurance practices. This is essentially the same language as the NAIC language does, but remember that's a ban on a life settlement, and this is not a ban. You may engage or enter into a life settlement agreement within that 5-year framework, and this lists the conditions that are exempt from that 5-year period. On line 10, the policy owner is terminally ill or chronically ill. Policy owner's spouse dies. The beneficiary dies, or the natural person that's related to them dies. They divorce a spouse. They retire. Those things are exempt, or if they become physically or mentally disabled and they can't continue their full-time employment. And then a court action. And there is, therefore, if you go down now to, you have to have all three. All of the following criteria are present. That's number 8 on line 24. This says, I'm going to need help. This I'm going to need help with, because this is one of the exemptions. Am I reading something incorrectly? I thought I knew this perfectly, but
no.
I'm going to ask Ms. Rowan to clarify here what happens at this point.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the way Section 8 works, the way the rebuttable presumption works, is basically on the concept of if it looks like a duck and walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it probably is a duck. And it relies on the telltale signs of a STOLE transaction to determine whether we have a duck or not. And so how Section 8 works is that if you have, you can do it to, you can look at it one of two ways. But the way it's written, it says basically that if the policyholder has some skin in the game, in other words, the policyholder has funded in some way or another the policy themselves, whether through traditional premium financing where there is recourse or they've borrowed their money from another source. The second part is that there is no agreement before the policy is issued to settle it. There's no guaranteed settlement agreement. That's key. And then the third one is that they did not undergo a life expectancy exam, which the Senator described earlier, before the issuance of the policy. And that is key, because the only thing you need a life expectancy exam for is to value a policy for sale in the secondary market. That's when they need to know how soon you're going to die, and that's the only time you need those. So those three things are telltale signs of a STOLE transaction. And you need, if you have one of those, then you fall in under the rebuttal presumption. But even if that's the case, there are 7 safe harbors if the senior is, in fact, in some sort of hardship situation.
Thank you. I knew that. I just couldn't say it. Okay. On page 8, the permitted settlement transactions. I think this is following law that Utah. We borrowed from Utah here. And it says that nothing in here keeps you from entering into a settlement contract. Okay. That's important. So then Section 7 is new language. I think it just comes from us and has to do with changing the ownership of the policy or changing the beneficiary. And the request for that governs this language on page 8 and into page 9 governs that. And section 8, fraudulent acts and remedy, starts at the very last line. I would contend that those are probably issues that the Judiciary Committee would be mostly concerned about. But and frankly, the whole bill could, you know, might better have started there. But I think it probably needs to end there.
I'm informed that it does have to go to that.
Yes, committee. Yes. We know that.
We know that.
But this committee's concern is that the insurance marketplace is not distorted so that life insurance for the benefit of your family and other financial planning. I mean, as you know, today life insurance policies are not the proceeds are not taxable to the beneficiary. We don't want to disrupt that kind of financial planning on the part of individuals. Already we're seeing an increase in the cost of life insurance for seniors because there's a presumption, I guess, that there's probably STOLI afoot here. And those, the prices for old people like myself are... I may be the only one in the committee who actually fits into this age group. So we don't want to disrupt that marketplace.
Let me make note that we're smiling because it's Yvonne Solon's birthday today. But she doesn't fit into this.
It today?
Yes, today.
Well,
happy birthday. So that yes. was very important to bring that
yes,
up.
Yes, yes.
Now let's get to the business.
So, and having said that, I think I'm going to let Ms. Rowan carry on here. I may have something else to wind up, but I know we want to move.
We want to move along.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, I'm Robin Rowan. I'm the executive director of MFSE. MFSE has been in existence for just over a year now. As I said, we represent the life insurance, long-term care, and providers of other financial security products. We used to be part of the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, but we felt the life insurance industry folks felt we wanted a more distinct voice. We formed our own organization. Our membership ranges from the four big domestic employers, Securian, Ameriprise, Thrivent, Allianz, to small not-for-profit fraternals like Sons of Norway and Catholic Aid. We have about 20,000 jobs in the state, in addition to the thousands of agents that distribute our products throughout the state of Minnesota. We are here today to ask for your help in stopping a practice, as we've said, called stranger-originated life insurance or STOLI. Under STOLI arrangements, the social purpose of life insurance, to protect a family, a loved one, a charity, is turned on its head, and it becomes a wager on human life. And I want to be really clear about what we're not here to do. We are not here to ask you to impede or stop legitimate life settlements in any way. If someone bought a life insurance policy, their needs have changed, they no longer need it, they should have a safe and transparent secondary market in which to sell that policy. I don't think it's a secret there are some insurance companies that are involved in some aspects of the legitimate life settlement market. And they do not feel that either the NAIC model or this particular bill here infringes upon that market at all. In fact, they feel that it actually enhances their investment because it cleans out the illegitimate bad assets. Finally, what we want to stamp out are STOLI scams. And we don't want life insurance to be used as a wager on human life. Now, that's not our term. We didn't make it up. It's what courts have for centuries called an insurance policy without an insurable interest. And we talked a little bit about insurable interest before, but basically just to review, it means the beneficiary has to have a stronger interest in the insured living than they do in the insured dying when they take out the policy.
I'm back and forth.
I know. So I'm adjusting. So what does STOLI look like? What happens in a STOLI transaction? Essentially, what is happening is investors are approaching seniors to do what they cannot do themselves directly. An investor cannot go out and take a policy out on my grandmother. If you handed an application to an insurance company and it said it was for Robin's grandmother and it said Goldman Sachs on the beneficiary line, we would say there's no insurable interest there and we would reject the policy. Investors cannot do that directly. So what they need to do is find a way to circumvent that. It's not all that different from a teenager who wants to buy some liquor. And they can't go buy it directly themselves. So what they do is they find an adult in the parking lot and they say, hey, can you go buy this for me? I hear that happens. It's not anything I've ever done. But it's the same, idea. You have to find someone to do something, a senior to do for you, which you cannot do for yourself. And that's what is happening with these STOLI transactions. And the idea is that they have to be hidden. They have to be hidden so the insurance company cannot figure out what is going on. And investors go to tremendous lengths to hide what these transactions are really going on for insurance companies. They do a number of different things. One of the things that they do is they can set up a trust as the owner of the policy. When you set up a trust as the owner of the policy, when the beneficiaries of the trust change, the insurance company doesn't know this. So when you switch out the grandkids and move in Deutsche Bank, the insurance company doesn't know this. And we try very hard to stop it, but if we don't know when the beneficiary change is coming in, it's very difficult for us to do that. And the way that they entice seniors to get involved in these transactions is exactly what Senator Scheid pointed out earlier, which is they say, sell your unused life insurance capacity. It's like finding a Picasso in your attic. And we will give you 2 years of free insurance and a little incentive up front, and then you get a big payout at the end at little to no cost to you whatsoever. And that's how the transaction looks. And the 2 years of free insurance is exceedingly important, and this is why. Insurance companies have 2 years to challenge a policy for fraud. If we find fraud in 2 years, we can rescind that policy. No investor worth their salt is going to buy a policy from someone during that two-year period, because if there is fraud involved, and with STOLI transactions, there usually is, the insurance company can rescind that policy. So hence, the investors pay for those 2 years of insurance. If the senior dies during that period, their beneficiaries would get the proceeds minus the loan amount. And then at the end of those 2 years, usually they wait 26 months, right, just past the contestability period, so the insurance company can no longer challenge it. That's when they do the switch. Another way they do it is with the non-recourse financing, using a policy as collateral. And the way that works is they say, we'll pay for the policy. You don't have to have any skin in the game. And then at the end of the policy period, you can buy back. You can buy the insurance policy if that's your choice. However, it's a false choice, because usually to pay back the loan and all the fees and all the commissions, it's either unaffordable or it's such a bad deal they won't do it. And that's the reason they're willing to loan the money to buy the policy with no recourse, because at the end of the day, what they want is to get their hands on the policy that, again, they couldn't go and buy for themselves because they don't have an insurable interest. Why is this bad? On the surface of it, you know, free insurance for 2 years, big payout at the end. What's the problem? There are a lot of problems with this transactions, both for consumers and insurance companies. For consumers, you rarely get what they told you were going to get after fees and commissions and everything else that's taken out, and then taxes on top of that. In some circumstances, you can actually end up owing back money. In addition, you only have so much insurance capacity. Each person can only take out so much insurance on their own life. And if you sell all your insurance capacity to investors and then decide at some point that you actually want insurance, you may not be able to get it. And this actually happened to Larry King, who sold his insurance capacity and then realized that he wanted some insurance for his relatively young family and was not able to get it. So that's another issue. For insurance companies, there's a number of different things. One is affordability and availability of life insurance. And that's not just for insurance companies. That's actually for all Minnesotans. If this practice continues, premiums will increase. We're already seeing it in the senior market somewhere between 50, I've heard different, between 15 and 25%. But at some point, everyone is going to end up paying for these few folks who are taking advantage of the life insurance system. The other issue is that life insurance enjoys specific tax privileges. The proceeds of a life insurance policy are not subject to income tax. The reason for that is for the strong social purpose of life insurance to protect families and charities and businesses. If life insurance becomes more for the benefit of Goldman Sachs, Deutsche Bank, Bob's offshore hedge fund, in this economic climate, we're very concerned about whether that protection would continue. And then life insurance will no longer be able to be the vehicle for protecting families and preserving wealth to the next generation. The next thing I wanted to say is that insurance companies devote significant resources to trying to stop STOLE. STOLE is basically multi-million dollar fraud, and we have a duty to our policyholders to stop it from happening. And even if we did not, if the services we did not, our reinsurers now say you have to have very strict anti-STOLE controls. But the problem is that they go to such lengths to cloak the transactions so that we don't know what is actually going on, that it is very difficult for us to detect. So what we are asking for today is the ability to help deter STOLE transactions, to stop them before they start. And it's analogous to the situation with a bank. Nobody expects a bank to handle, to stop identity theft on their own. Do they have a responsibility to their depositors? Absolutely. But there are things in place in the law that help deter the activity to begin with. So that's what we're at, that's why we're asking for your help. Why this approach? We have a different approach. You've heard about the NAIC, the NCOIL. We developed a different approach. Last year, we had the NAIC model with the five-year moratorium. We heard a lot of concern about the five-year ban. And so what we attempted to do was to find a more surgical approach that would not impose a ban on sale. So there's nothing in here that bans the sale of a life settlement policy. And so how does the bill stop STOLE? How does the bill stop STOLE? A number of different ways. Senator Scheid mentioned the definition of STOLE on page 3, line 3.27. That is the NCOIL definition, which the opponents like. It has only one word change, plan to act. But so what this bill does is it defines STOLE and then prohibits it. We don't think that's enough. There needs to be a deterrent. By the time you're in court arguing whether STOLE happened, it's already occurred. We would like to stop it before it starts. So this is important, but we don't think it's enough. The next thing we have is the presumption. And I want to spend just a little bit of time on it. I know we talked about it a little before. But I want to spend... Did
you want? Bill, I know. I just...
I'm
worried about the time.
Let me just...
and I think we can...
We've got about 18 to 20 more folks here, and very important issue, but we can move along just a little bit faster, so...
Okay, well, I think... Then I will wrap up, and I just want to be very clear. The rebuttable presumption does not impact legitimate life settlements. The only way you fall into the rebuttable presumption is if one of the telltale signs of a STOLE transaction are present. And the point of the rebuttal presumption is not to end up in court. The purpose of the rebuttable presumption is to deter STOLE and to shift the risk onto the investors and to send the message that buy legitimate life settlement policies, don't buy STOLE policies. And we think that's the only way to effectively deter Stoli transactions.
Yeah. Okay. So. Brother, I'd see you have about...
Mr. Chairman, you have the agenda with the people who are,
yeah, there's
are coming
four.
Up.
I've got four witnesses, supporters of the bill. Bruce Ferguson, David Wishmeyer, Domino Spazzetto, and Rick Cleveland. Oh, it's Dominic. I thought that was a pizza guy, Dominic.
I'm going to move down.
Senator Gerlach.
Mr. Chairman, when we have some questions. When would that be an appropriate time to ask?
Yeah, I think that'd be all right. Yeah, go ahead. Do you have questions at this time? Yes, go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll have a few questions, but the first one right off the bat is 5 years. Why 5 years? Right now we have a two-year the insurable interest, or I'm sorry, the contestability period for 2 years. Why 5 years? Where did that number come from, and what's, does it have any significance at all to this?
Ms. Rowan?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gerlach, good question. 5 years is intended to be a deterrent because the premiums, the investors, it's too hard for them to finance premiums for 5 years. They can finance them for 2 years. They can't really finance them for 5 years. Is it somewhat of an arbitrary number? Yes. But it seemed to be the exact right, to hit the right point. And that is the number that the NAIC 50 insurance regulators picked. And the significance is 2 years, again, is the contestability period. So saying you can't do something for 2 years or saying the rebuttable presumption only applies for 2 years is nothing more than the status quo, because investors aren't going to buy a policy when the insurance company can still come in and challenge it for fraud.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, another question on the presumption of Stoli practices. The way the bill is structured, I know that Senator Scheid went through that, and because I don't like the ban at all. I mean, I think there is a legitimate market here. And so, but we have the items listed. There's seven items, which are life-changing events, which one would believe that would be a time when you might want to look and tap some assets you have. But then the question arises, okay, what if you just want the money? What if you just need the money? It's your private property. Why should you have to... why does a spouse have to die? Why do you have to have be terminally ill? Whatever, all these different things. But then you've got down the bottom, you've got these three items. What I want you to do is just kind of track me, see if I understand this, because I'm sure other committee members are having difficulty grasping how this all fits together as well. Is that where it would be? Is the kind of answer to the question of what if you just want the money? It's your personal property. Is that where you fit that in the item 8? Where it says all of the criteria are present, and you list those three litmus tests, and I believe that you said that these are the obvious signs of a Stoli agreement. You said if it quacks like a duck, walks like a duck, et cetera. This is the quacking and walking here?
The duck section, yes.
This is the duck section. Okay, so these three things, all of them would have to be met, meaning if you're paying the premiums, you haven't made an agreement to do this, and you haven't had a life expectancy evaluation. If you meet those, then you can, just because you want to, you can do this then, right?
Yes, you overcome.
Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator Gerlach, yes.
You overcome the presumption.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Well, right. And just a clarification, there is no property right in a Stoli policy. If there's not a valid insurable interest, you don't have a property right. So it's only if you have a legitimate life insurance policy do you have that property right. And if you have a legitimate life insurance policy that you want to settle, this rebuttal presumption doesn't apply at all. So you can go ahead and settle it within those 5 years. The only time, as you said, it applies is if you have one of those telltale signs. And then even if you do have one of those telltale signs, but if you are going through one of these significant events, then the presumption doesn't apply. But it doesn't at all ban you from selling the policy.
So, Mr. Chairman, so you're saying in some cases a Stoli arrangement, if it quacks like a duck, might be okay?
Yeah, if you're sick. No. Mr. Chairman, Senator Gerlach, we're saying that in some circumstances, if a senior is in some of the dire circumstances that are listed in this, we don't want to prevent them from getting their money. even if it is a duck.
Oh, okay. All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Not a sick duck, is it? Or is it a duck? Okay. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Ferguson. You may identify yourself. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bruce Ferguson. I'm Senior Vice President with the American Council of Life Insurers. We are a national trade association whose members account for 90% of the life insurance in force in the great state of Minnesota. We count among our members Allianz, ING, ReliaStar, Ameriprise, Securian, and Thrivent. And I'm pleased to be here to speak in strong support for Senate File 166. I won't repeat many of the important points that were made by Robin as well as Senator Scheid. In the interest of time, I know you have a lot of people to get through. I'd just like to say a few things. Minnesota is a hugely important state, and this is a hugely important issue. I've tracked this issue for the better part of 2 years now, working through the development of model legislation at the National Association of Insurance Commissioners and the National Conference of Insurance Legislators. And what you have before you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is the best elements of both of those models. These very types of provisions have been considered and enacted by some legislatures already in 2008 and will likely be considered in other states in 2009. Just yesterday, I testified before the North Dakota legislature, which enacted the first DOLE law of its kind 2 years ago in 2007 based on the NAIC model. And they are looking at strengthening that law because there are developments that are addressed in this bill, for example, the use of trusts to avoid detection, to avoid insurable interest, so that trust arrangements can facilitate stolen transactions. That's a loophole that they want to close. That's a loophole that could exist here, does exist here, without the enactment of this legislation, and certainly needs to be addressed. This is an extremely well-crafted bill, one that focuses in laser-like fashion, we believe, on STOLE while protecting legitimate life settlements. The five-year rebuttable presumption, as Robin and Senator Scheid described, really does operate to address those issues that have the characteristic of STOLE. You have to ask yourself, and I hope you'll ask the question of the opponents to the bill, follow the money. Where's the money coming from? And where's the money ending up? Is the money coming from a third party, someone who's paying the premiums for the insured? And is the money ending up through the death benefit in their pockets with maybe just a residual amount as sort of a pass-through to avoid the law? Is that what's happening here? And the five-year rebuttable presumption applies in only those situations where, as the senator mentioned, all of the life-changing circumstances would not apply to the five-year rebuttable presumption. You'd also have situations where a person pays for the policy the good old-fashioned way, through their own money, using their own collateral. They haven't had a guarantee of a settlement value or an agreement to sell the policy, and they haven't had a life expectancy evaluation. In those situations, that presumption would not apply. Over the last 12 months, I've worked in many states on this issue, and I think, as I can predict, the opponents to the legislation will say that the five-year rebuttable presumption is anti-consumer, anti-property rights, and for the reasons we've just discussed, we think it protects legitimate settlements while focusing in a targeted way on those transactions that are characteristic of STOLE. They will say, well, don't do 5 years, but instead do a definitional approach. Define and outlaw STOLE. Use the NCOIL model as the basis for addressing STOLE transactions. And once they get you focused in that direction, they'll say, well, it really didn't mean the definition, the broad definition of STOLE. It's too broad. It sweeps in many types of transactions. We'd like you to narrow that definition. We'd like you to narrow the premium financing restrictions and other protections to the point where, unfortunately, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you would end up having a bill that legitimizes STOLE by making it so narrow that it wouldn't encompass those types of practices that we see in the marketplace. So I'd ask you to be on alert for that type of approach because we don't think it would end up with the type of very strong framework that you have before you in Senate File 166. The last point I'd make, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions, is, as was mentioned earlier, the Stoley transactions really undermine the social purpose of life insurance. And it calls into question, when you have Stoley transactions proliferating, why is it that Congress gives the favorable tax treatment it does to the tax product? It's intended to provide benefits for families, for businesses, for charities, not for investors. And if that's what's happening here, in the environment that we operate in, with the budget being of the nature that it is at the national level, clearly this issue could be on the table. We fear that having lost the tax benefit and the tax treatment for the millions of Americans who rely on it solely for the purpose of third-party investors that have no insurable interest in an individual is bad public policy, and we'd like to do whatever we can to keep that from happening. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Vandiver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, to Mr. Ferguson or somebody, well, first of all, I think anybody with anything is at risk right now. So federal budget is. But I have a couple questions. How many life policies have been used in Minnesota in a Stoley transaction? Do we have some? And some of this you might have covered. I had a bill up in another committee, but
Mr. Chairman, Senator Vandiver, since these transactions tend to be cloaked and hidden from the insurance company, we don't have a record of how many policies are Stoley policies.
Well, do we know how many have been sold in the secondary market? How big this is?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Vandiver, it's growing exponentially if you look at the numbers that, and I don't know that I have it right in front of me, but what's happening on Wall Street with major investment firms purchasing packages of these securitized agreements. So if maybe the department might be able to answer it, but I mean, we're talking hundreds of billions. We're up over $100 billion, I think. I'm going to look for the number of how it's grown in the last few years.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, I'm having trouble with that 5 years. It seems to me I would be quite nervous to do something that I'm automatically in trouble for, or might automatically be in trouble for, that I might need an attorney for, or whatever, just on that, the complexities of the 5-year issue.
And Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman and Senator Vandiver, I don't know if you were in here when we talked about the exceptions to the presumption, and then if you purchase this policy with your own funds, you're making the payments. If you didn't have a life expectancy evaluation, it's not an exam, it's an evaluation, right? And they didn't have an agreement when you purchased the policy that you were going to settle or sell it, then you have no quarrel, I think. You would have no problem whatsoever.
And there's not a big dispute about that?
It's pretty clear, and it's on page 7 on the presumption. And actually, what you have there on the presumption of Stoley practice, you have the statement that there is a presumption of Stoley, except or unless one or more of the following conditions have been met. And it lists 7, and number 8 has 3 factors. But it lists 7 conditions: if there's a divorce, if you retire, if you become physically or mentally disabled, can't work full-time anymore, et cetera, the spouse dies, you have a need to change, or, well, you don't even have to have a need. If any of those things happen, you overcome the presumption within the 5 years. And number 8 is those 3 things I just mentioned.
Well, what if those don't happen and I want to sell it, though?
If those don't happen... If you financed it yourself and you didn't have a life expectancy evaluation and you didn't have an agreement, a prior agreement,
you can sell it.
You can sell it.
So what are these things for?
Public relations.
Public relations.
There, yeah. Mr. Chairman and Senator Gerlach's helpful. I mean, I think that those are concerns. If somebody becomes terminally ill, we didn't really go into viatical settlements, but this all started with viatical settlements in the 80s and people who had AIDS, and it was believed to be a terminal condition, and at the time it was, and people were policies.
Why don't we try to get some more testimony? Maybe some of the questions might be answered by the testimony. We're almost an hour already for the supporters. So, David Wischmeyer, please. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chairman and Senators. Thank you for allowing me to testify today on behalf of the proposed legislation. My name is David Wischmeyer, and I'm an attorney with the Brehm Group, an insurance brokerage in Minneapolis. I've been in the insurance industry since 1990 and am a chartered life underwriter as well. My firm specializes in specialty life insurance for estate planning and business continuation planning. We have put in place over $1 billion of insurance coverage in my time with the firm. In addition, we are involved with legitimate life settlement cases. My role today is not to represent insurance companies, but instead represent my clients and future consumers of life insurance in Minnesota. The proposed bill will help eradicate STOLE transactions, and by doing that, help legitimate purchasers of life insurance in the senior markets. It may be beneficial to describe the distinction between STOLE and legitimate life settlements. I agree with the professionals, some in this room, that do legitimate life settlements, that it is good for consumers. It gives the consumer another avenue to sell their products. The traditional policies that have been sold have changed. The new type of insurance policies provide very low-cost guaranteed coverages, but if you want to cancel the policies, the residual value or surrender value isn't as great as it once was. So the life settlement market provides consumers another avenue to liquidate their policies and get value for those policies, which is very good. But there is a distinction between selling a policy that I once had a need for or wanted for my family or business protection and then selling that policy to just having a promoter come up off the street and say, you're old, your health is questionable, buy a policy and then we'll buy it from you and you'll get a lot of money for it. My experience has been that those transactions have a lot of hair on them. Most of the time, the details of those transactions are not disclosed adequately to the consumers, and the consumers end up getting a lot less than what they had originally bargained for. In addition, on my side of the business, when we're selling legitimate insurance policies for reasons like family protection or business continuation planning, we found it much harder to transact business the last couple of years. This is for a number of reasons. First of all, the administrative burdens now are much greater. Insurance companies are asking for complete trust documents in order to ferret out whether or not it's a STOLE transaction. This has implications for privacy for families, as well as the time and expense of having the attorneys do the document production. In addition, I had one case where we needed to draft an affidavit indicating that it wasn't going to be a STOLE transaction in order to complete the transaction because my clients fit the perfect mold for what's going on in the STOLE world. However, the most important piece or detriment that STOLE is causing, I think, is the fact that insurance prices are increasing for seniors. Over the last several years, insurance pricing has gone down across all younger insureds, both female and male. In the 65 and over market, however. Actuaries have told me that the reason prices are increasing despite mortality gains is because they're trying to price adequately for STOLI to protect themselves from STOLI. And that hurts everyone. And another factor Robin pointed out is the insurance capacity. Clients, I do not believe, are adequately told, hey, if you sell this policy and 2 years from now we'll need another policy, you may not be able to get it because you will have to disclose whether you've done this, and then you might not have the capacity to get additional coverage. We've talked about the five-year rebuttable presumption and some of the things in that presumption, including a life expectancy report. I've heard some opponents of the bill say that the life expectancy is needed when you do general estate planning. Well, I was in estate planning practice for a while. I polled many of my colleagues here in town. No one has ever, ever got a third-party life expectancy calculation completed for legitimate estate planning techniques like GRATS or sales to defective trusts or whatever it may be. The most we'll do is we'll look at IRS tables to come up with a calculation in order to make sure it meets the requirements of that technique. We may actually have a doctor give us a letter saying we think our client or insured will live at least a year. Certain IRS techniques require us to live 12 to 18 months in order to get favorable tax consequences. But like I said, I've never seen an attorney recommend getting a life expectancy report done by 21st Century Services or AVS or one of the big providers. I've also heard that the concern is the life settlement industry will dry up if a bill like this passes. And in fact, in other states, it has dried up. That's simply not true. The reason why life settlements are harder to do now is because of what happened in the financial sector in September. You know, the credit market is in disarray. So you can imagine if you're trying to go out and look for capital to buy assets, it's hard to do. And that had nothing to do with proposed legislation or the fact that certain bills have passed. As a matter of fact, Deutsche Bank pulled out of New York completely with their life settlement business just because they couldn't get credit here in America. So, you know, that's a misnomer as well. Finally, legitimate premium financing, another one of the rebuttable presumptions, generally requires that the insured or grantor or the purchaser of insurance have some skin in the game. They have to either post collateral, sign a guarantee, or at least pay for part of the premium. If you don't do that, why would you do that as a lender? There's only one reason you do it is because you know you're going to get the policy on the back end of the deal. And so that will not hurt legitimate premium financing either. Thank you, Chairman and Senators.
And Mr. Chairman?
I've learned a couple of new insurance terms today, skin and hair. some new ones.
I know, Mr. Chairman. Skin in the game just sounds painful to me.
Okay.
And
your hairy remarks. Chairman,
yeah, in my hair, I could use a little more. Mr. Chairman, the next two people, I probably can come up
together
at the same time. And they'll be
Dominic, right?
And Mr.
Sposetto.
And here.
And Rick Cleveland from the Minnesota Fraternal Congress. Welcome to the.
Hello.
I'd like to see you guys. We could probably do this in 4 or 5 minutes. It'd be wonderful.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dominic Sposetto. I'm here representing the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors in Minnesota. It's a group of about 2,000 insurance agents that sell life insurance, annuities, long-term care, disability, and health insurance products in Minnesota. And many of you have these members in your districts. We are very concerned about STOLI and are here in support of Senator Scheid's legislation to prohibit that practice in Minnesota. We think these manufactured transactions are merely designed to circumvent insurable interest laws, which we think are very important to the life insurance industry, and could jeopardize the public policy of life insurance, which is to protect families and businesses from the loss of a spouse or a business partner, and to provide financial security for both. And we'd hate to see that jeopardized by these investor transactions. You've already heard from the experts in the field. I just want to make a couple of very quick comments on behalf of the agent community. If you allow STOLE to continue, it will affect us all. Now, you've heard how it already affects the 70-year-old-plus seniors who may get into this transaction and then find out that they have taxes and legal fees that weren't originally disclosed to them, and more importantly, that they have used up their insurance capacity in this investment scheme and no longer are able to purchase insurance in the marketplace. But it also affects all of us. It has a larger and more long-term effect on the pricing and availability of life insurance, and we are very concerned about the fact that it's now already starting to put in administrative stops and whistles in trying to provide life insurance to people who I think are purchasing life insurance for the correct reasons. And it's also, and you've heard this mentioned before, it could affect the tax benefits of life insurance sold in America, and I think that's very important. Right now, life insurance is purchased for protection, and therefore it is given a favorable tax treatment. If life insurance becomes purchased as an investment, our fear is that we will lose that favorable tax treatment and it will affect the whole industry. There's some mention of property rights, and first of all, I think the question is whether a STOLE transaction actually creates property rights or not, and I'm not versed in that, so I'll let the attorneys figure that out. But the point I'd like to make is that state government has had opportunities and has put rules and regulations that affect property rights all the time. We do it through public health regulations. We do it through zoning ordinances. There are a variety of things that are done in the public interest that ultimately affect property rights, and I think that may be an argument in this case. And last, I'd like to say that you're going to hear everyone come up here and say that they want to eliminate STOLE transactions. And obviously, we all agree on doing that. The problem is, where do you set the line? We've heard that the earlier proposals that used model drafts, we found that weren't adequate because they didn't cover all the various contingencies or legal avenues that could be set to create a STOLE-like transaction. So I'm encouraging you to set the line as far as we can to prohibit this practice. And keep in mind, you can't cover every single contingency. There are going to be cases, what if, when, and how, that someone will bring up. And the point is, there is no perfect legislation. And I think what you want to do is to set the line in the sand to where we can deter the STOLE transactions, and hopefully this issue will disappear for the next few years. So I would encourage you to support this legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, any questions? Mr. Cleveland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Rick Cleven, I'm Vice President with Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Fraternal Congress. You might have not have heard of the Congress, but we're an organization of 30 or more fraternals in the state. You've probably heard of the Knights of Columbus, Thrivent, Catholic Aid Association, Sons of Norway. A lot of our members are quite small. We're membership groups. We have 550,000 Minnesotans that belong to one of our fraternals. And we're about two things for the most part. One is community service. We have local organizations of lodges throughout the state that do volunteer work, millions of volunteer hours. And we also offer life insurance and related products, those kind of protective products to our members. They are regulated much like the products that commercial companies offer. Frankly, we haven't seen a lot of STOLE transactions at the fraternals. We suspect the large reason for that is that we're membership groups, and it's kind of tricky to get a stranger transaction within a membership group. We have had a few at Thrivent that have snuck through. But despite the fact that it doesn't hit our bottom line directly, we are very supportive of Senator Shide's legislation to stop the STOLE practice. We're very concerned about how that will affect the viability of life insurance, a very important product to our members, and we think it's bad for consumers. So we thank you for the ability to testify today.
Okay, we've heard from any questions of supporters, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Shide. This is just kind of a general question. I support your legislation. I'm just wondering about, when we've heard so much about the difficulty of enforcement, of ferreting these out, is this going to become an additional expense for the Department of Commerce? And if so, could it be offset? Would the insurance industry be willing to offset that expense?
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, I think there are people from the department. If I could just ask them maybe to comment on that. I don't know who all is here. I haven't turned around. Hello.
Back. Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, the way this bill, the major portion of this bill in terms of the STOLE deterring aspect is meant to be self-enforcing by requiring the investors to determine before they buy a policy if, in fact, is STOLE, if the three telltale signs or ducks or hair or the telltale signs are present. So the largest aspect of it is intended to be self-enforcing and would not have an impact on the Department of Commerce.
Senator Scheid, has the department taken a position on this legislation?
I have someone
is that
here.
A fair question. How are you? What's your name?
I'm Robert Commodore. My name is Robert Commodore. I'm the Director of Investigations and Consumer Services for the Department of Commerce. We have taken a look at this bill. We have some interest in this bill. We have a companion bill that you'll hear about later on licensing for, on the strengthening the vehicle settlements. Senator Olson, we do have some concerns about this, but we feel that this bill will help us in our ongoing investigations. We don't believe that this will add any extra burdens on us, but we certainly believe that will help us as we continue to protect the rights of the consumers. We've been very active with the NEIC, with the Model Act. We did say okay to the Model Act, and we believe that this bill and the companion bill will help us in our work in addressing the many concerns that we have presented by this change in the marketplace.
Now, Senator Scheid, this is not brand new legislation, and you have some concerns. Sometimes around here, we like to iron out the concerns before the bill is introduced in the second year. But
well, Mr. Chairman,
so you still have concerns? You're not for or against the bill? And
I want to clarify. We don't have concerns with the bill.
I thought I heard that. Okay,
we have concerns in the marketplace that we believe this bill will help us to address, not the bill itself.
All right.
I'm sorry if I confused you.
Well, I've been confused before. So. All right.
And I know we have the room till at least 3, so I think we have fair enough
time. Okay, that'll be fair.
Because I know it took some time to explain the bill. Not all of that was, you know.
Sure, and I think there's other committees, though, too, that start at 3. So, but
right,
we'll go to
right.
5
go
or 10 minutes of 3. Okay, are we ready for the
yes, and I'll
opponents? We got a Carl Walk, Ralph Stillman, and Sarah Cole. Now you can one at a time or 3 at a time. I'm not concerned how you want to proceed. These are what on the list called citizen testifiers. Welcome, citizens, and you all state your name for the record.
I'm Carl Walk, Mr. Chair. I live in 11750 Vista Drive in Minnetonka, Minnesota. And every time it just seems to be that I hear the word insurance or insurance agents, I always have a flashback to that Woody Allen film where he robbed the bank and the judge sends him to spend his sentence in with a insurance agent. So, but I was very happy that I had the agent I did have, because without him I probably would have been almost destitute. I'm going to be 76 years old in April, and in 2003 and 2005, I took on life insurance policies to protect my family and my company. I had owned a business in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, for about 44 years, and I wanted to protect my investment in that company and my family, of course. I sold the company in 2005, and I was to be paid out in a buyout over 5 years. In October of 2007, those who I sold the company to under poor management And since they had a 50.1% controlling interest in my company, the company went into bankruptcy. They owed me a lot of money. All my assets were tied up in that business. The assets of the company were all I had. My agent explained the option of selling my policies rather than surrendering them. I couldn't afford the payments anymore. Given my situation, I could not pay the premiums and was faced with losing the coverage. I sold the policy. It was like a financial miracle. Without the sale of those insurance policies, I would have been down the tubes. I'm 76, like I said, almost, and my working, especially days in this economy, I'm sure almost over. I'm healthy, thank goodness. The funds I receive from the policies will enable myself and my wife to be comfortable for our remaining years. I paid about 25 or 30% of the settlement in taxes. I do not understand all these insurance terms. Like I said before, it just kind of shakes us up. I couldn't even read the bill because too confusing. But I understand as a citizen, though, I would have been prevented from selling my policies. I plead with you not to take away that right of a senior citizen to do that. I don't know what I would have done without having the opportunity to have sold those policies and give me financial stability. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much,
Senators.
For the next.
My name's Ralph Stillman. I don't have a title in this. OOC, old citizen. I'm also 78, and I'll speak from my experience. Several years ago, I started doing estate planning, and my wife and I have six children, and so it can get kind of complicated, and our goal, obviously, is to provide for the kids. Life insurance became a very big factor in our estate plan, and I purchased various policies, different types of policies. The one thing about an estate plan that you can be sure of is it changes. It can never cover every situation. And with six kids, that situation also changes. And our ability to help them became paramount in our mind. Unfortunately, with life insurance, to help them, we have to die. And that wasn't preferable. So we looked and were told about selling off some of the insurance that we had bought, looked at the cost of it. Unfortunately, a lot of those policies were tied to the stock market returns. So, you know what happened to our cost of insurance as a result of that. We couldn't project out far enough to last long enough to keep those going. So, fortunately, we were able to come out well with those, take care of the kids, and the one thing that we realized is that. Changes happen fast. I'm very concerned when I hear any relationship to time, 2 years or 5 years. I know we have to live with 2 years now, but I would be very concerned if I was in this situation and I had to wait 5 years. I think I've covered everything. Thank you.
Very good. The next, welcome.
You'll have to forgive me. I've just come out of the sick bed, so I hope you can hear me and understand me all right. My name is, by the way, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for letting me speak. My name is Sarah Jane Cole, and I'm 69 years old, and I am unfortunately divorced as of 2004. And at the time of the divorce, as probably many of you know, in the divorce decree was a provision for spousal maintenance security, which is life insurance. And my former husband and I had been married 41 years. I was a dependent spouse and raised our family and assisted him in the business. And so he was to pay the premiums on, there were two life insurance policies that he chose to do and took out at his age 64. A few years later, there was a post-divorce divorce, I guess you'd call it, at which time we wound up making a settlement that was much lower than the original situation, and in it, I wound up being the one to pay the premiums on the insurance policies. And I found myself in a situation, I didn't have that many assets that I got in the divorce, found myself in a situation where my income level was lower than what I needed, and I was also now going to be paying the premiums on the life insurance policies. And the one thing I did not want to do was sell my home, which was my main asset, because even though it's a modest home, it's home, and I needed that for my own emotional security. And I live in a neighborhood of people who couldn't be more wonderful. So anyway, I had a few assets that I was fortunately able to sell off, and they were kind of Band-Aid things. And as time went on, I reached a point where two friends that are financial planners and my accountant all individually had said to me that I needed to sell at least one of these life insurance policies because I could not afford to pay the premiums. And so I happened to run into a man who could facilitate this type of thing. And even though the insured, who was my former husband, was only 68 years old, this man was able to find a way for me to sell this one life insurance policy, which has given me more Band-Aid money, even though at that age I didn't get a lot of money, but a Band-Aid amount to help me through, and at a time that I did not know what I was going to do. The housing market had fallen. I couldn't sell my house even if I wanted to, and I was really in trouble. So I am a strong supporter of it. However, I am also very aware of what I've heard today and already knew myself, the original intent for life insurance. And so I am also a firm believer that the life settlement should not be used as just an investment vehicle for someone. So I think that's primarily what I wanted to share with you. I don't know what I would have done without being able to use it in an appropriate way this time. Thank you.
Senator Vandiver.
Mr. Chair, maybe to these witnesses, so if this bill was law, would you not have been able to do your transactions?
Definitely. Time would have wiped it out.
Mr.
5 years would have wiped it out.
Is that correct? Senator Scheich?
Mr. Chairman, from what I've heard in the testimony, I think in all three cases they would have been able.
The
time wouldn't have had anything to do with it because, first of all, the divorce is one of the exemptions, but also if you had purchased this policy and paid for it yourself and you didn't have a life expectancy evaluation at the beginning of your when you took out those policies, then
I had policies that I had both types where I had to go out and get some financing. I needed a lot of coverage for the kids, so I bought those types of policies as well.
Senator Olson, did you have a...
Mr. Chair, maybe I'm misunderstanding, but I thought what your bill was addressed toward are situations where someone doesn't have an insurable interest in the first place. And in all of these situations, it sounds like you had an insurable interest in the first place.
If I may, Mike Abrams with Tamar Fink. A couple things. One is both Ralph and Carl had life expectancies drawn on them before they bought their policies. We do that with everybody over the age of 60. The Brehm Group may not. I think they're irresponsible not to. It is a matter of how you service your clients, and timing on a lot of estate planning issues is important. And also when we go into the marketplace to purchase insurance, We want to know what the life expectancy is. Have our own set of criteria, so that we can negotiate the best possible rate with the insurance companies. To go out and get a life expectancy on a client is not a crime. Okay, it is not something that should put our clients at risk or take away their rights. It is something that we do automatically, no matter what, for any client age 60 and above. We want to know what their health issues are, how long that they may or may not have to perpetuate their planning and transactions, and to help them get the best possible coverage.
Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if that entirely answers my question, and I guess maybe somebody who was in support of this and understands the complexity of it better could address whether each of these situations would have been prohibited under this bill.
I think that's a fair question. Anybody, I mean, could they have done this?
Mr. Chair, maybe Ms. Rowan can respond better.
I think that's...
Mr. Chairman, I think that retirement is one of the
criteria,
one of the exemptions.
Exemptions, I mean.
The divorce is an exemption. Physical disability or
bankruptcy.
Yeah, insolvency. Yeah.
So those might have been covered, probably. Sir, did you have a? Could you?
I'm happy to address.
Yeah, take just a minute, though, please. Come on up. And this is important, I think.
I can stand.
Mr. Chairman and the senators, it's hard to know exactly whether or not all three of these people would be able to settle their policies. There's a lot that goes into every transaction. My experience has been that based on what I've heard, the fact that they'd own the policies and that there was an insurable interest at the beginning, you said to protect your businesses and your family, and that you own them, they would have been able to settle the policies or certainly rebuke the rebuttable presumptions. Second of all, to your point, we are not irresponsible for not doing life expectancies or doing life expectancies. The reason his firm probably does them is because they're involved in STOLE transactions. Thank you.
Ooh. Ooh.
Please leave your address. No, we're not involved in STOLE transactions. We've never been sued on a STOLE transaction. This is the first we've ever been accused of a STOLE transaction. But be that as it may, we did STOLE transactions before we knew that there was a life expectancy market or a secondary market. So be that as it may, going through this bill a little bit, they would not be able to sell these policies even if they had the right to sell them. Because, quite frankly, the way the bill is drawn, it is going to take away, if not their right, it will take away their ability to sell their policies in this state. And the reason why is our bill is going to be unique among all other states. Okay? And we have in this bill you have basically an unlimited contestability period, if you read on. In a lot of cases, the contestability in this bill goes 3 years beyond the death of the insured. So under those circumstances, people will come up here, and they will, and they're going to tell you, people who are in the life settlement industry are going to tell you that they are not going to be interested in buying a policy that could be contestable forever. And that's what will take away their ability to sell the policy. So what we're asking for, basically, is that our bill and our STOLE and IOLE bill be such that it is compatible with the 49 other states. And we feel that this bill will not be, and will basically eliminate all settlement activity in Minnesota. And That's where we're at on this. To another point about Senator Scheid, you talked about whether you know, you thought it was a perverse act that's going on. Well, you know, I'm just in the middle myself of dealing with a lot of Madoff clients, okay? And the insurance policies that they have are about all that they have. My father was one of them, okay? And I took the remaining assets that he had, and I bought a life annuity, all right? And a life annuity is a reverse of a life insurance policy. He gets an income for as long as he lives, and then when he goes, it stops. It's basically a life settlement is no more than a single payer on the other side. Okay, it is the same bet. Okay, it is the same. It's the same aspect. Somebody is buying a policy, and they get paid. The shorter the lifespan, the better it is for that person. Same thing with a life annuity. Okay? My father bought a life annuity. We bought it from him from Lincoln National Life. If he lives for 10 years, it's a bad deal for him. If he only lives 2 years, it's a very good deal for him. It's the same type of aspect. It's just a different name. So anyway.
Probably not a good deal either way. If he lives a short period, he gets more dough, but that he's... Yeah, okay.
So
I get it. I think you three, unless there's questions, are excused. And thank you for your help.
We have
we've already met Mr. Abrams, and now you want Mr. Sabes, is it, and Mr. Devon? You want them to come up at this time? Now, welcome to the Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection, and state your name. I guess there's two of you,
One John Sabas.
Okay, welcome.
Thank you.
Kevin Devon is my name.
Okay, you can proceed as you'd wish.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and distinguished members of the committee. My name is John Sabas. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of GWG Life Settlements. We're a Minneapolis life settlement provider company who purchases life insurance policies in the secondary market. It may be interesting for the committee to note that Minnesota has played an important role in the development of this market, first with ViaCare, who was institutionally funded by Cargill Financial Services, and later Living Benefits, who Kevin is associated with, who is funded by Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway. We are institutionally financed by two of Europe's largest banking groups. We provide seniors owning life insurance with a meaningful financial option with respect to their policy. We welcome a regulatory framework for Minnesota and its consumers, and we thank you for your careful consideration of the legislation proposed. With respect to this bill, I'd like you to know the following. It is unique, and because it's unique, and if it's adopted in its current form, we will no longer purchase policies in the state of Minnesota. And our competitors, who I talk with on a daily basis, will no longer buy policies in the state of Minnesota. And therefore, Minnesota will no longer have a viable secondary life market. The legislation today addresses how insurance companies sell their product, yet it does not hold them accountable for those practices they complain of. Instead, it attempts to penalize or hold our industry accountable for their own agents' actions. Before you pass legislation, please ask the following questions. Who are the consumers this bill seeks to protect? What consumer complaints has the department received regarding STOLE transactions? And what disciplinary actions have insurance companies taken against their agents and the people perpetrating this activity? The legislation before you shifts the burden to our industry as if we, not the insurance industry's own agents, are the promoters of STOLE. We don't purchase STOLE, and we do our best to uncover it and where it's used. The law of the land is clear on this. Insurance policies procured without an insurable interest are not valid. We don't support this legislation because it's overly broad, despite its characterization that is laser-like precise. And we don't support this legislation because it clouds the legitimate title to life insurance policies purchased in the secondary market with its rebuttable presumption. That said, we welcome a regulatory framework that both sides can agree on, such as the uniform laws that have been adopted in many of our states. And we welcome a regulatory framework that protects consumers, such as one that requires notice to a consumer that a secondary market exists before they allow a policy to lapse or be surrendered. And we welcome a regulatory framework that provides stability and clarity so that a vibrant, competitive secondary market can exist for Minnesota's seniors. Thank you again for your consideration to this most important topic. We hope that Minnesota will continue its leadership in protecting seniors while allowing them to avail themselves of this most important financial planning tool. Thank you.
Senator Vandiver.
Mr. Chair, would you rather we waited with questions or?
You can go ahead to ask your question.
What is it? How much money are we talking about? What is the difference in dollars gained between just giving it back to the insurance company or selling it on the secondary market?
It really depends on an individual situation, but a lapse policy is simply allowing it to lapse worthless. Typically, in most cases, we pay 4 to 7 times the surrender value offered by the insurance carrier. It's a lot of money. It's huge. Our process is based on actuarial math. The life expectancies are necessary. We're not taking advantage of anyone. It's the same actuarial statistics that the life insurance company uses for their business.
And secondly, do the proponents agree that it will be contestable beyond the 5 years and that it makes it gives it less value on the market? Or
who wants to? Rowan, I guess you can answer it. Yeah. Got the other.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Vandiver, no, we do not agree that it's an unlimited contestability period. The contestability period is 2 years. That's it. We only have 2 years to contest a policy for fraud. I think what Mr. Abrams was referring to is that there's a right in the remedies section for the estate to recover the proceeds from the investors if Stoley was in fact involved. And the idea that doesn't help the insurance company because we're paying it either way. We'd rather pay it to the family than the investors, but that's not an unlimited contestability period.
All right, we're going to get back to the Senator opposition. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To me, this
Rowan, why don't you, unless we need some explanations later, I think it's the opposition's time. We're a little loose. We'll let you try to, if we need a question, probably come back up. But Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I had is sort of like what Senator Vandiver asked, except coming from the opposite direction. It seems like what I've been hearing is that, you know, this is really like the same as a reverse mortgage or you know, we're coming at this from the other direction. But you talked about you're paying $4 to $7 worth the cash value that they'd otherwise get. But maybe they were only going to get, a very small amount of money. I'm more interested in how much are you making on these policies, these transactions, in comparison to what the consumer gets. So I don't know whether you want to call it the rate of return for your investors, or once you've done one of these life expectancy and you've come up with the overall, you've determined how much money this is worth, you know, by using your actuarial studies. And there's a percentage that you're going to be making, and there's a percentage that the person's going to be receiving. That's what I'm interested in hearing about.
Sure. I'll address it without telling what the IRR of our portfolio is that we acquire and manage, but it's really based. Each policy is like a snowflake. They're highly complex financial products that are sold, whose returns are really based upon the actuarial studies that we do with the unique individual. The returns that we earn on our portfolio are in the higher than 10%, lower than 15%. So it's not a very significant high annualized return that the institutional investor is attempting to seek, which thereby allows for this 4 to 7 times payment for the life settlement in the secondary market transaction.
Okay, now the insurance manual. We have hair, skin, and snowflakes.
Yeah, there you go.
our vocabulary is growing rapidly here. All right, let's move on. Senator Olson, do you have a...
Well, and Mr. Chair, just in follow-up to that, I would have to say that to really analyze that, I think we'd have to know a lot more than just the rate of return that, you know, your investors are getting. We'd have to know how much your company is, you know, paying to its... We'd have to... I'd like to just know what percentage of that dollar is coming out, whether it's going to returns or whether it's going to your salaries or whatever it's going.
Life settlements is pro-consumer, it's productive, and it's a wonderful tool. The dollars that we put out go back to the consumer's hands. The dollars that we put out go to earn profits for our employees, and the dollars that we put out and the investments we make are locked inside that settlement and earn return for our investors. And it's quite simple. It's not, you know, rocket science.
That's not if an answer, Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson, yeah. Sir, did you want to take off here?
If I could add, my name is Kevin Devine. I'm a principal in a life settlement provider company called Living Benefits Financial Services. I have much the same background and education as the gentleman from the Brehm Group, although I started in the insurance industry in 1978. I'm a chartered life underwriter. I understand the industry some, I think. Life settlements are pro-consumer. They add social and economic value. We've heard that from folks who have benefited from that. Companies like ours are representing investors who are managing and acquiring portfolios, and that's where our duty runs. From that perspective, we get real pragmatic, and that is that this bill itself creates Minnesota as an island. You know, to help answer the earlier question, part of what we do is analyze portfolios, and I remember a report that I looked at May 11th where we analyzed almost 8,000 policies, and not a single one of those policies had been written originally by at least three of the four companies that are represented here on the proponent side. I'm not quite sure whose ox is being gored from that perspective. And I don't know why that's the case. These carriers' policies just don't get settled, whether they're, you know, 2 years old, 5 years old, 10 years old, 15 years old. Looking at all of the policies all up, you know, they're really represented by, you know, different carriers. And I had to kind of think about, well, how many Minnesota residents were there in that batch of 8,000? Really only about 30 or 40 that I can think of, because a lot of folks change their residency to Florida or to Arizona when they get into the 70s in that kind of category. One of the things that concerns me about this bill, and the reason why I would just not look at any reasonable relationship with Minnesota, is does an Arizona resident that has a trust in South Dakota for the rural perpetuity in estate planning and a cabin in Minnesota fall under this bill or not? As a business person representing an investment community, I'm just going to stay away from that. I'm not even going to get into those line-drawing problems. I just can't. There's just no real reason to do that. There are plenty of policies from states that follow some of the standard legislation that we can run our business on. And so, you know, it's really pretty pragmatic and pretty simple from that perspective. There are in some of those other bills disclosures about how much brokers make in relationship to insureds, how much providers make in relationship to insureds. I think there needs to be a reasonable economic relationship in value brought to the whole marketplace. But the line drawing and the throwing these kinds of rebuttable presumptions. I've got a letter here from a gentleman who had to sell his policy after 6 months. And it's a very articulate, very heartfelt letter that he sent to the carrier, requesting the carrier to acknowledge the change of ownership because the carrier resisted the change of ownership. And his set of circumstances didn't fall into any one of these rebuttable presumptions, but they're real. And it's his property and it's his asset. And the carrier ultimately relented and, in fact, affected the ownership. One final comment I'd like to make is the producers who have talked about struggles like, you know, the people Dominic represents, who are talking about struggles and getting new policies issued, are really reflecting the opposite of the carriers themselves using their own underwriting tools and their own financial analysis tools to discover whether or not the risk they're about to take is viable. I think that's great. I think that's what capitalism, I think that's what the insurance carriers should be able to do, and they are doing. The law as it exists today allows that. It protects consumers in that regard. It protects carriers in that regard.
Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Doug Head and Jeff Tegler.
Welcome to the Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection. And
thank you.
May proceed. Always state your names.
Thank you. Jeff Tegler. I'm a principal in the insurance firm Garrity, Tegler & Barley, Wealth Strategies, LLC. I'm also a citizen witness, I guess. In the way of educational background, I have a JD, CLU, CHFC, CFP. I've been active in NAFA. We engage in life settlements incident to our insurance practice. And I appreciate the opportunity to address this committee. I applaud a lot of things in this bill. I applaud the bill's effort to define statutorily insurable interest. I agree that at the inception of the insurance contract, it's imperative that the owner of the policy have the required relationship with the insured. I applaud the definition of stranger-owned life insurance. I also applaud the effort to prevent transactions where the initial ownership of the insurance is just a sham to create the illusion of an insurable interest. Concerned, however, about the rebuttable presumption of stole practices for life settlements entered into within 5 years of the date of issue of the policy. I'm concerned that the requirement could prevent perfectly legitimate life settlements and that it might adversely impact the price that Minnesotans get on legitimate life settlements. Let's imagine you're 67 years old, and for one reason or another, you purchase a term policy. Perhaps you're purchasing it to make up for your family losses in your investment portfolio. Imagine a whole number of legitimate reasons to take out the policy. After 4 years, you decide the policy is no longer needed. Perhaps your investment portfolio is recovered. Perhaps something in these 7 life-changing events, something else has occurred that we can't anticipate. The rebuttable presumption is this is a stole transaction. Well, then why doesn't my client wait, in this hypothetical, another year to settle the policy? Well, the problem is the policy may be convertible only for the 5-year period, and you can't sell a policy that's not convertible. So the client would have to do it now or not do it at all. In many instances, the client may need to do it now. I'm not clear about how you rebut the assumption. I assume the questionnaire that the insurance company can demand prior to changing ownership will ask my client to clarify, to certify that he, one, paid the premiums with his own funds, two, there was no understanding or agreement to life settle the policy, and three, he didn't undergo a life expectancy. Is the signed certificate alone enough to rebut the assumption? Do we have to provide additional evidence to rebut the assumption? I just am not clear on that. But let's assume we meet that hurdle and the insurance company cooperates and is willing to change the owner. Will my client get full value for the policy from a potential purchaser? I don't know. I'm not buying these policies. I can't evaluate what's being said. But my guess is the policy won't be marketable. It seems to me the purchaser would face at least 3 potential risks. One, the insured's estate may initiate an action to recover the death proceeds. Did the questionnaire that was required on the change of ownership rebut the stole presumption or not? I guess I'm not clear. Two, the insurance company may bring a declaratory judgment action to void the policy as late as 3 years after the date of death, even if this occurs many years in the future. Three, in addition, there's a threat of what amounts to an additional fine of up to 2 times the death benefit for a willful violation. I don't know, but it's my guess that no institution would be willing to purchase this policy when they can purchase policies from residents of other states that don't face these risks. And that gets me to my second point. Is it prudent to take a direction that no other state has taken? Are we negatively impacting the price Minnesotans can get for their policies? I'm not smart enough to know. However, I think it's important that we acknowledge the fact that the more Minnesota's law differs from the laws of most states, the greater the risk that we're unknowingly doing something that will negatively affect the value of, quote, legitimate life settlements. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Okay. We got about another 15 minutes. Sir?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm pleased to be here. My name is Doug Head. I am not the former Attorney General of Minnesota, but I am the Executive Director of the Life Insurance Settlement Association, a national trade group. I've been traveling around the country in recent years, frequently appearing before bodies like yours, considering legislation in this arena. We support the well-crafted model which was adopted by the National Conference of Insurance Legislators and which received nearly 40 hours of public hearings and discussion involving legislators from many states like yourselves representing themselves and their states before that body. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners Model Act, which we do not support and which includes the original seed of a five-year ban, was adopted in largely secret sessions. There is a lot of evidence on the table that the process was flawed. There is a lot of evidence on the table that the process did not involve very much public input at all. And many of the provisions in that act are objectionable to us, principally the five-year ban, which seems to have been snatched out of the thin air as a tool to get at investors in the industry. This proposal, in my view, gets not only at investors in the industry, which has well been testified to by the potential investors in the industry, but it also, in my view, really goes after the unfortunate consumers of Minnesota who you've heard from. I would draw your attention particularly to the written questionnaire, which not only we've talked about this rebuttable presumption idea, but who has to rebut the presumption ought to be a focus of this committee's attention. The rebuttable presumption has to be rebutted by a consumer in the state of Minnesota who answers a questionnaire, a hostile questionnaire, which assumes that they've done something wrong, and then asks them subsequently to provide independent evidence that they have not done something wrong. What that independent evidence is, we don't know. What they might say is all subject to fraud prosecution. All of this is designed to thwart the legitimate right of consumers to sell their policies, and we think this is a very bad idea. I would add that the proponents of this legislation in the American Council of Life Insurers and other industry trade groups in the insurance industry have been vocal in their support of good models which have been passed in other states, which we also support. Last week, Washington State considered an excellent bill, which we support and the life insurers support, to regulate this industry in a constructive fashion. We would urge you to look closely at that Washington State model. Additionally, or as it is emerging. Also, both the life insurers and our organization, the life settlement industry, supported an excellent bill, Senate Bill 1543 in California. The life insurers, in dealing with that, said, and I quote, "A remarkable coalition emerged on behalf of this bill. We were joined by major consumer groups, including the AARP, as well as leaders of the life settlement industry in support of vital legislation to protect seniors from unscrupulous STOLI schemes. In supporting that legislation, I believe they put themselves on the record, a record which you can rely upon to pass good legislation in this state, and I would urge you to follow the NQL model and those of the many other states that are moving in that direction. It's a good law. And we would urge you to support it, not to go in this insular way that is being suggested in this proposal. Thanks.
Okay. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Coyle. I think I'm the final witness on behalf of the so-called opponents of the bill. First of all, I want to acknowledge Senator Scheid in giving us the opportunity to visit with her to express our concerns. And we know that she cares about this issue. She's conveyed that to us privately as well as publicly. Our comments in opposition to our bill are not made out of a lack of respect for her, but really with a goal to try to find a constructive compromise. We would say respectfully is not present in Senate File 166. Mr. Head has just indicated that there are a number of other models in which the insurance companies and the life settlement industry have actively worked collaboratively to pass legislation without the five-year ban that we think is present in the current form of Senate File 166 as a rebuttable presumption. But I want to pull back from the complexities of the current bill and just try to get back to some very simple points that perhaps have been overlooked as part of this debate. First of all, the Minnesota Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court have said for more than 100 years that when you receive life insurance properly issued at inception, you have a property interest that allows you to sell, to give away, to do what you will with your property. And we would say respectfully that Senate File 166 fundamentally alters that concept. And I would say it borders on potentially being an unconstitutional infringement on that property interest. So that's point one. We start from the standpoint that the Supreme Court has said, this is your property, you can do with it what you will. Point two, the legislation provides this rebuttable presumption concept, which is very complicated. It's going to require consumers to go to lawyers to figure out whether they have a right to sell their policy. And then secondly, they got to run the gauntlet of the insurance companies through this questionnaire process before they can determine whether or not they have the right to transfer the policy. Thirdly, we know that this industry is growing. It's been testified to on both sides. It's generating hundreds of millions of dollars worth of transactions. Those are taxable events. We're clear about that. That's a tax impact to the state of Minnesota, and it's a tax impact to the federal government. And that's a, if this bill passes, it would be our view, respectfully, that there will be a negative tax consequence to the state of Minnesota. And in this budget climate, you know, that's an issue that ought to be at least thought about by somebody. Fourthly, if you've looked at a life insurance policy or an application for a life insurance policy recently, and I've got several in my briefcase if you'd like copies of them, they are full of questions that are designed to ferret out from you whether or not you have any intention, any thought, any hint, any vague recollection or idea that you might pursue a life settlement transaction. And they use that policy properly, we don't object, to ferret out the individual who is seeking to commit an illegal STOLE transaction. And we support that. And we think that any bill that passes out of this body ought to very directly target STOLE transactions and make it illegal. We support that. But the insurance carriers will say, and I've got a handout that I can get you, and it may already be part of the record of the committee, but I've got a document that reflects quotes attributed to major life insurance CEOs, all who say, we got STOLE under control. We know how to find it, and we know how to stop it. So if that's the case, you have to ask yourself, why is this bill here? On top of that, we've heard the Department of Commerce say that we don't have any evidence of fraud in Minnesota. So again, you have to ask yourself, what are we doing here? What's the goal? What's the objective? There's already a two-year contestability period that everybody accepts. Why is it necessary for Minnesota to go beyond that? The only thing we can identify is that the life insurance companies with the interest on a, I would say respectfully, a moral level on the part of Senator Scheid, see that there's a concern that STOLE transactions are occurring that we can't detect, and we understand that she's got a her desire to try to stop fraudulent transactions from occurring in Minnesota. We do not object to that. We are committed to work with her on that, and we would be willing to work with the industry in trying to craft a compromise bill that addresses the needs of the insurance industry, addresses the needs of the Department of Commerce and the state, but most importantly, addresses the needs and the rights of consumers in this marketplace. Mr. Chair, those are our comments and questions. If you have other questions for me or for the members of the panel, we'd surely take them.
Any further comments by the committee members?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a good discussion. That document that Mr. Coyle was talking about is in your
Okay, thank you. I wasn't sure if it had been distributed.
Yes, it was.
The chair approved that.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I did authorize that to be put out, obviously. I could move around here. I'm just going to stay here if I can.
You're fine. That's fine.
We know we can stay in the room, but I also have a committee meeting at 3 o'clock, and so we can take a few minutes here. I guess want to wrap up. One of the most important things I want you to take out of this, though, is that this is not a ban. And I think the presumption can be overcome. And I believe that a really appropriate forum for that would be in the Judiciary Committee. And I know Senator Olson is there. I'm there. And if we think that there is something that's been said here today then I think we can do it there. I'd like to ask the members to move this bill and re-refer it to Judiciary. It would have to go there, obviously. One of the biggest problems that we have is that there's this cloaking that happens, and the companies, the insurance companies, are not able to always to discern that. And so I think the bill lays out those exemptions. There's eight exemptions, and remember, number eight has the three prongs. But if you are and you may still overcome it, even if you secured some financing, you may still overcome that. And in many cases, I think that could be overcome just by one of the first seven, because they'll stand separate. Each one would be an exception. So this isn't a ban on life settlement agreements. It really helps us get at the stranger-originated life insurance. We are not ahead if we enable or allow to continue this action, if you will, against the insurance company. They're not knowing what the risk is, and it's just automatically going to cause costs to go up to other people who are just trying to purchase life insurance for the traditional role that life insurance has paid to protect your family in the event of your death or your business partner. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd move. I don't know if you want to ask if there's anybody else that wants to say anything or not at the risk that there might be someone, but I would be happy to to have someone if they want to. But I'd like to move the bill as amended.
Before that, Senator Scogin had his hand up. Did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Scheid, you know, we heard some testimony about people just not being clear on the taxation issue, not being clear on the ability to get insurance in the future. Could that, in other transactions, could that be handled with a waiver that it's explained to people, they sign off on it? Somebody explained this to me. And, you know, when you do a property transaction or a car deal now, there's 35 pages of initials and signatures before you get to the end.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure. I think it would be good to ask the department, perhaps, on some of that. Now, you want to know about the disclosures. They are coming with – the department is going to have a bill concerning viatical settlements, and I don't know if the commissioner or somebody would like to speak to that piece. I don't know if that's covered. I haven't seen that draft yet. But I believe it probably would have to do with disclosures and transparency.
What I kind of get out of that question, it was kind of a new disclosure up front that you would – or no, that you would fully explain that
what
could happen.
The consequences of
the consequences of that. The other eight disclosures or disclosures.
Right.
But a new one up front. I think that's what this was, Senator Scogin. Is that kind of on the right track there?
Right. And Mr. Chairman, just there is another bill that's coming that's going to be redoing how we regulate viatical settlements, and I don't know if there's disclosure language and or requirements in that. Maybe somebody from the department could help me out on that. In any case, Senator Scogin, sometimes, and I don't think we heard all the stories, all the things that could happen to someone, but if they are financing the premiums, there may be charges that come back at them afterward that they don't know about, whether it's fees or commissions or those kinds of numbers that people end up having to pay that they didn't know. They think they're getting, let's say you're getting $300,000 for a $1 million policy. I don't know if that's legitimate. I shouldn't say legitimate, but I don't know if that's like reality or not. But let's say that. You're wanting to know, do you know that you have a tax consequence for that $300,000 settlement? You may have other expenses that go with it on top of that. But in any case, one thing I can tell you is that you'll get more for that if you're not going to live as long. You'll get more in a life settlement if your life expectancy. Well, Mr. Chairman, I mean, that's just really important.
Sure it is.
To think about. Okay.
We'll hear from Mr.
I'm sorry.
Wilson. The commissioner, and then we're going to vote at 2:45.
Mr. Commodore.
It gives you a lot of time, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Glenn Wilson, Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, Minnesota. To answer the question, we're often asked to help develop disclosure statements, and in an awful lot of the life insurance area, annuity areas, we do have checklists that we review and ask the salespeople and the companies that they're proposing the product that these documents be available to us in often cases. And specifically on the viatical question, ask Mr. Commodore to comment.
Again, as Senator Scheid mentioned, there is a companion bill that we will be bringing on the viatical, and that will have some disclosure statements in it. Again, we're trying to tighten up the market. But again, the disclosure statements, as you mentioned, oftentimes it's 36 pages of statements, and another disclosure statement would be just that. It would be another statement. Is it important to have it there? Yes. Is it the absolute tool that's going to change and modify this behavior? No. So we need these other pieces as well. But the disclosure statements are in the other bill that will be presented.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move.
She's got there's another step here, and that's a judicial committee. But
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that Senate File 166, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Judiciary Committee.
On that motion, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Aye. Motion prevails. It will be forwarded to the HUT. Senate File 166 will be go to the Judiciary Committee. The meeting, Senator Scheid, any announcements or anything here?
Mr. Chairman, then we will not be meeting on Thursday. We will, however, after that, we're meeting every Tuesday and Thursday.
Okay.
Into July, wherever. August, or whatever it is.
No vacations this summer. Huh? Okay, with that, the meeting's adjourned. Thank you, everybody.